Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Have you ever met a psychopath? To judge by what we see in the movies, the only people who fit the description are raving madmen. In the movies, at least, they are usually men, cackling with delight as they clutch bloody knives above their latest victim. So offhand, most of us would say, no, I have never met a psychopath. But if you believe the estimates that as many as one in every 25 human adults meets the clinical definition, you're suddenly faced with the chilling truth that, of course, you've met a psychopath, and that it might be somebody you see all the time. Author John Ronson explored the subject and spent time with both the man who created a commonly used diagnostic tool for the condition and with several people who match the description for his new book, The Psychopath Test, A Journey Through the Madness Industry. John, welcome to Think.
Hey, nice to talk to you.
So you were not just sitting around the office thinking, I want to hang out with psychopaths. Can you talk about how you found your way to the subject?
Exactly. In fact, the last thing I really wanted to do was hang out with psychopaths. I'm quite an anxious person, so really it kind of goes against what my amygdala is telling me to do. My amygdala tells me to just stay in and not hang out with people who might want to kill me. but it was really the statistic I heard a few years ago that just stayed with me because it seemed like such a huge thought. And the statistic was that 1% of the general walking around population is a psychopath. 25% of prisoners are psychopaths, but they're responsible for 60 to 70% of unrest in prisons. So they're the rock thrown in the pond. And 4% of high-achieving business leaders are psychopaths. So you're four times more likely to have a psychopath in charge of you as you are to have one as your subordinate. And that struck me as such a giant thought. I always kind of thought, well, one day I'd love to find out whether it's true or not.
So one of the things you did was page through a copy of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, which, by the way, I have to tell you, if it didn't cost $99, I think I would run out and get a copy because it sounds like a fascinating read.
Yeah, it's incredible. We're into the fourth edition at the moment, and it's now, it used to be about 100 pages, and it's now 886 pages, so they've discovered a lot of new mental disorders these past couple of decades. I was leafing through it wondering whether I had any mental disorders and, you know, of course, instantly diagnosed myself with 12, usually around the anxiety spectrum, plus nightmare disorder. I definitely have that because that's categorized when you have recurrent dreams of either being pursued or declared a failure. And every dream I have involves somebody chasing me down the street yelling, Ronson, you're a failure. and then I noticed that, that there were certain disorders like antisocial personality disorder and narcissistic personality disorder, which, again, that part of the checklist was a mad striving for power and respect. And again, I thought, well, you know, is it possible that our irrationalities, our madness, the things that would be defined in the DSM as a disorder, are more powerful engines in our lives than our rationality? And if that's true about our lives, is it true about society? Is psychopathy really the brain anomaly that remolds society all wrong? So everywhere I was looking, I was seeing madness and seeing the power of madness.
Well, let's talk about society being molded in certain, you know, large institutions in society. Lots of people are aware of the fact that the Church of Scientology is absolutely against psychiatry, psychology, any sort of acknowledgement that mental illness is a real thing. Talk a little bit about what you learned about L. Ron Hubbard.
Well, it's the anti-Scientologists say that it all came from the fact that L. Ron Hubbard tried to get the psychiatric community interested in his alternative book, Dianetics, and they spurned him, and that set about a sort of lifelong hatred of psychiatry. But certainly he set up a crack team of anti-psychiatrists called the CCHR that exists to this day, and they're determined to destroy psychiatry and psychiatrists. And I thought it would be interesting, because I kind of do this in my books, to to bring them into the story. So I ended up having lunch with them, and they ended up being quite, in some ways, quite a useful resource for me, even though I'm completely opposed to their polemical ideology. And I'm in no way an anti-psychiatrist. I thought it would be really interesting to bring them into the story. And in the end, they got me into a mental hospital. I asked them to prove to me that psychiatry was a pseudoscience and couldn't be trusted. And they ended up getting me into this mental hospital.
As a visitor, we should say.
Yes, as a visitor. Although you always have this slight neurosis when you visit some of those places that they're not going to let you out. To meet a guy called Tony, who they said had faked his way in there, faked madness, and now he was stuck. And the more he tried to convince the psychiatrist that he was sane, the more they took it as evidence that he was crazy. So that's really how my journey began, going into Broadmoor with the Scientologist to meet this guy, to see whether he really was sane and really had faked madness.
So Broadmoor is now called Broadmoor Psychiatric Hospital, but it used to be called Broadmoor Criminal Lunatic Asylum.
Yeah, it was one of the very first, this Victorian monstrosity, you know, where they would put all the serial killers.
Mm-hmm.
All of Britain's most notorious serial killers.
Is it scary to just walk into a place like that, even though you know that there are guards and there are measures taken to keep everybody safe?
Yeah, I mean, it's very depressing. It's depressing in a slightly different way to the way you think it's going to be, because it's now quite modern. It looks like a kind of giant, never-ending Hampton Inn with all pine and calming colours. And the air conditioning is just a constant, loud, bad sigh. It kind of goes, So it's very depressing for the minute you get there. And yeah, because it's the place that's filled with people who can't help themselves. So it's just very, very sad. And I was there with all these parents who were meeting their kids for a Sunday lunch, and the parents were all dressed up, you know, nicely. It was just heartbreaking, you know, seeing, and their kids would be coming in from the wards, have Sunday lunch with them. And of course, Sunday lunch at Broadmoor basically means chocolate and cups of tea from the machine. So yeah, it was not a happy place. Although at the same time, you know, whenever I go to places where people aren't supposed to be allowed to go to, I always feel slightly excited and honored to be in these mysterious places. So there was some excitement as well.
Yeah, I can relate to that. When I was an intern reporter, I got to go into a men's federal prison, and it was just the coolest experience I had ever had at that time.
It is kind of amazing. I mean, 10 years ago, I went to a Ku Klux Klan compound for my first book there, and also in The Menesteric Goats, I, which was another one of my books. I was going to places where, you know, military bases, and, you know, it's the best job. It's the greatest job in the world in some ways.
So let's get back to Tony. He initially had committed a violent assault and thought to himself, or this is the story that he tells, that if he just pretended to be insane, he would have a softer time in a mental hospital than in jail.
Yeah, he thought nurses would bring him pizzas, he'd have a PlayStation. He would have done 5 years if he'd just gone to prison for his crime, which was beating a homeless man up. He would have got 5 to 7 years. But, yeah, he faked madness and faked it much too well. Came up with all sorts of horrible, lurid fantasies that he told psychiatrists, mainly gleaned from movies he'd seen, like A Clockwork Orange and various David Cronenberg movies. So faked madness much too well and was immediately sent to Broadmoor and instantly said to the psychiatrist, "There's been a terrible misunderstanding. I'm not mad." If he'd just done his time in jail, he would have got 5 years. And he's been, by the time I'd met him, he'd been in Broadmoor for 12 years.
Hmm. Well, here's the sort of first of many turns that we find in this book, because you meet with his therapist and they say, "Oh, yeah, we know he faked his way in here, but that doesn't mean he's not a psychopath."
Yeah, I mean, this was just incredible. His clinician said, "Yeah, we accept his story." The minute he got to Broadmoor, his delusions, which had all seemed quite cliched anyway, just drained away. But we've assessed him and we've decided that what he is a psychopath. And in fact, faking your brain going wrong is exactly the kind of cunning, manipulative act of a psychopath. The fact that he was better dressed than all the other patients, he was wearing a suit to meet me, that was more evidence that he was a psychopath. The fact that he didn't want to hang out with the other serial killers on the ward because he found them distasteful. That speaks to lack of empathy and grandiose sense of self-worth. So all the things that seemed most sane about Tony were evidence, according to his clinician, that he was a psychopath.
Well, the interesting thing there is that, you know, once you've been labeled in a certain way, it does seem true that whatever you do that might be normal or rational in another situation suddenly is evidence that you really are far gone.
Yeah, especially in somewhere like Broadmoor. In fact, I gave a talk last night in London and somebody came up to me who said he worked in a medium secure unit. And he said the thing that's most frustrating for the patients is that any kind of behavior that would be considered a little bit annoying in real life, like, for instance, creating a PlayStation avatar that looks like a mocking caricature of one of your nurses, is like a big deal. And there's reports go back and forward. And imagine, you know, the Kafka-esque, suffocating awfulness of that. Coupled with the fact that actually Tony probably is a relatively high-scoring psychopath, but I mean, that's jumping ahead slightly in the story. The big thing, the big problem, if you're trying to convince people you're not a psychopath, is that two of the items on the checklist are cunning, manipulative, and pathological lying, and then another item on the checklist is lack of remorse. So if you say, "I actually feel very remorseful," psychiatrists will immediately say, "Oh, well, that's the typical cunning, manipulative, and pathologically lying thing a psychopath will say. He'll claim to have remorse when he doesn't."
Do you have a copy of the book in front of you?
Yes.
Okay. On page 97, you list, at least in the U.S. edition, you list the items that are on the checklist. And I wonder if you would, I know it's 20 things, but if you would read those for us, because I think we kind of need to have that in our heads to talk further here.
Yeah, you're right, and I will. Item one is glibness, superficial charm. So the fact that, you know, they're very charming and charismatic. And pretty much every psychopath I met, you would say, was a very charming person. Grandiose sense of self-worth, need for stimulation, proneness to boredom, pathological lying, conning, manipulative, lack of remorse or guilt, shallow affect, which is a really interesting one. It means an inability to experience a deep range of emotions. So you get the kind of eerie sense that they just pretend to feel emotional and are just acting emotions. Callous lack of empathy, which I think is really the big one. The lack of empathy is the thing that leads to all the other things. Parasitic lifestyle, so, you know, being a pimp or something like that. Poor behavioral controls. Promiscuous sexual behavior, early behavior problems. It always tends to manifest itself around the age of 10, which leads some researchers to think that it's something that you're born with. Lack of realistic long-term goals. Impulsivity. And in fact, impulsivity is very interesting because the critics of the checklist say, well, how can you be impulsive and also conning, manipulative? Isn't that describing two different sorts of people? Irresponsibility. Failure to accept responsibility for own actions, many short-term marital relationships, juvenile delinquency, revocation of conditional release, which obviously means if you've committed a crime and you're let out, you do something to get yourself back in there, and finally, criminal versatility.
Well, we'll let everyone ponder those while we take a quick break, and we'll be back in just a minute with author John Ronson. His new book is called The Psychopath Test, A Journey Through the Madness Industry. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
Yeah. You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is author John Ronson. His new book is called The Psychopath Test, A Journey Through the Madness Industry. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So you just read for the things that Robert Hare's checklist checks for. By the way, something called a checklist seems far too informal for something as important as a diagnosis of psychopathy.
Well, that's certainly what I thought when I first heard that's how people were diagnosed.
Yeah, but, you know, it's funny. You read down that list, and I think most of us can maybe I'm speaking only for myself here, but can identify at least occasionally with probably a dozen of the things that you mentioned.
Well, I've got one that I'm a definite, which is need for stimulation, proneness to boredom. But actually, you know, the fact is there is a big difference. I started off very skeptical about the checklist, and I still believe that mental health checklists can lead to, you know, terrible, terrible abuses of power, and routinely do. The worst in America being childhood bipolar disorder, where kids with temper tantrums are getting labeled bipolar. But with psychopathy, the problem with psychopathy and the problem that psychologists have is that, unlike most mental disorders, it's not obvious. You have to be a sleuth to root it out. Mm. So they needed to find a way, because these people do exist. I mean, there's no question about it.
Yeah.
Psychopaths do exist. And so they needed to try and find a way of identifying them. And this was what they came up to. And it's definitely not perfect. However, I do think that the checklist, I've met enough psychopaths now to know that there's strange echoes in the nuances of behavior. And the nuances of language, that's something really interesting. For instance, I met, we're jumping forward a tiny bit here, but I met a CEO who'd been accused of being psychopathic, and I did the psychopath checklist on him. And when I got to manipulative, he said, well, that's leadership. Yeah, getting people to do what you want them to do, that's just leadership. And I also met a Haitian death squad leader who said to me, yeah, if you get people to like you, you can manipulate them to do whatever you want them to do. So time and again, they say very similar things when they're slightly caught off guard. And that's what the psychopath checklist is trying to tap into.
We'll go back to that CEO in a couple of minutes, but I want to talk about the Haitian death squad leader. This is a guy, Toto Constant. And what was really fascinating about your encounter with him, and he was in jail for something sort of unrelated to his psychopathy. Mm-hmm. But when you initially met him, you sort of liked him. You thought, you know, he was charming and chatty and you know, self-effacing. Yeah. And then you realized maybe he was just reflecting back to you what you wanted to see.
Yeah, he was kind of playing me.
Yeah.
The thing is, as an anxious, empathetic person, my terrible weakness is that I tend to judge people entirely on whether they like me, which is like a terrible way to live your life. But I went to visit him in jail in upstate New York, and sure enough, he was being just delightful. I mean, I'm a kind of slight, you know, slightly kind of nerdy type of man, and he was acting that way towards me. And he kept on talking about how all the other prisoners were, like, really impressed that the guy who wrote The Menesteric Goats was coming to visit him in jail, and he borrowed a special shirt to meet me. And I was obviously melting. And finally, he kept on saying, I really want people to like me. It's very important that people like me. And finally, I said to him, well, listen, you know, surely that's a weakness to desperately want people to like you. And that's when he said, oh, no, if you can get people to like you, you can manipulate them to do whatever you want them to do. And he suddenly realized, my goodness, that's exactly what he was just doing to me. He was just playing me.
You actually went and took a seminar with Robert Hare, who is a Canadian psychologist who came up with this checklist that we were just talking about. First of all, what sort of regular person outside the psychiatric profession would need to be able to spot psychopaths running around on the street?
Right. Well, it was mainly professionals who were at the seminar that I went to. There was a lot of care workers from, you know, high secure units or medium secure units. There were also people involved in parole hearings and so on. And this is a huge use of the Hare checklist at the moment. In fact, we did a This American Life a couple of weeks ago on this, if anybody heard it. that these days people's fates are being determined by how high they score on the hair checklist.
Right.
That's how powerful this checklist is now. You'll also get these rather sleazy criminal profilers, the kind of people who go on, you know, court TV and so on. They'll do it. But you know, nice, empathetic women end up marrying psychopaths, and I think it's probably quite a good idea for those people to know what it is that they're dealing with. So I think it can be. However, of course, there's a terrible seductive danger in starting to use the psychopath checklist like an out of control machine gun, just labeling everybody with it.
So, like, it's part of Match.com's list of sign-up characteristics.
I think OkCupid.com does the psychopath test if you want to do it.
So what's to stop people from lying about their actual feelings?
Well, that's the problem with psychopaths, is that they do lie all the time. So it's very hard to do the test. It's very hard to get them to do the checklist themselves. Obviously, if you're bipolar or if you've got OCD or any kind of regular disorder, you do the checklist yourself, or you're certainly involved in your own diagnosis, certainly if things are going well. With psychopathy, it's never a good idea to do that, because they're manipulative and they think of people just as their playthings, and they really lie and just don't care if they're caught lying. So they're not great people to be involved in their own diagnosis. But of course, that can lead to terrible Orwellian nightmares if you're being diagnosed from afar, which is what happens routinely with people who are diagnosed as psychopaths.
Author John Ronson is my guest. His new book is called The Psychopath Test. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. Let's take a call now from James in Fort Worth. Hi, James.
Hello. I was listening to the list that John had there, and honestly, a few politicians that I met, every single one fits at least a bunch of those items.
What do you think about that?
And business leaders. I mean, there's no question. And I was worried at first about going down that whole psychopaths rule the world thing, because it sounds quite glib and it sounds quite an easy thing to say. But after 2 years writing this book and hanging out with these people, I did come to that conclusion that psychopathic character traits make you excellent politicians because you're ruthless. And more than that, our society rewards these negative characteristics. Capitalism rewards psychopathy. Business rewards psychopathy. So, you know, it's our own stupid fault for allowing these people to lead us.
So we're not just talking about Hitler and Goebbels. We're talking about other people that we might consider to be more acceptable.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. I mean, the case study that I do in detail in my book is Al Dunlap, who ran a bunch of companies in the 90s. And every time he remorselessly closed down a plant, always with a quip, the share price skyrocketed. So the more ruthlessly and remorselessly he behaved, the more he and the shareholders were rewarded. And there was a very direct correlation between working people losing their livelihoods and their towns closing down, and the shareholders and the boards of directors and Dunlap himself getting richer and richer.
Let me digress for a minute here on Al Dunlap, because just talk about the place where he lives.
He lived in a giant mansion in Florida, in Ocala, Florida, which is where they breed horses. And it was filled with sculptures of predatory animals. He had a giant collection of sculptures of predatory animals. And in fact, the hair checklist talks specifically about how they see the world in terms of predators and prey, and it would be foolish not to exploit weaknesses in others. And the first thing he did when he invited me to his house was give me a guided tour of all these predatory animals. And he was saying, oh, I love predators. The predatory spirit is exactly the spirit I admire. So again, a sort of eerie, the fact that the same words he used was extraordinary.
What was his response when it became clear to him that you were there to find out if he was a psychopath?
Well, at first he looked annoyed and disappointed, as did his wife and bodyguard. But after a while, he became really quite intrigued by the list and wanted me to do the checklist with him, and really redefined a large number of the items on the checklist as leadership positives. So things like shallow affect, he would say, well, you know, who wants to be weighed down with nonsense emotions? When I asked him about cunning manipulative, he said, well, that's leadership. Grandiose sense of self-worth, which would have been very hard for him to deny because he was standing underneath a giant oil painting of himself at the time. He said, well, a man's got to believe in himself. He doesn't fit into every item on the list. There's no evidence of promiscuous sexual behavior with him, or many short-term marital relationships, or juvenile delinquency. So some key ones he doesn't fit into. However, and we could all think of leaders who do fit into those things. However, a great many of them he confessed to.
You know, what's really interesting here, John, is that this test, you know, the hallmark traits are this absence of conscience, absence of empathy, inability to feel love. Picturing a human being wired that way is terrifying, but it's also really sad.
Yeah, it is. And in fact, I talked to Robert Hare about that. Do psychopaths ever feel depressed or lonely? They don't feel anxious. Because actually psychopathy is the neurological opposite of anxiety. So they don't feel anxious. But sometimes they do commit suicide. I don't think it's very rare. I don't think it's very common. Mm-hmm. But they do it. So there must be a loneliness. There must be a loneliness there.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Houston and speak with Sean. Hi, Sean.
Hello there. I have a friend who's a pedophile, and he recognized it and got himself into therapy and turned it around. Now, I don't know if pedophilia is a psychopathic thing or a sociopathic thing, but he realized that what he was doing was wrong. And so many of the traits that you read out of your book there were things that he had. And once he recognized all of these symptoms or whatever you want to call them, you know, he understood what drove him and what kept him going. So my question is if a person doesn't want to be a psychopath, can they actually... not voluntarily, but, you know, I guess voluntarily, decide that they don't want to be that anymore and enroll themselves in therapy.
Does therapy work, John?
Well, I mean, that's really, really interesting. Firstly, there's not a great deal of evidence that therapy works for psychopaths because most psychopaths don't want to change. And so things like cognitive behavioral therapy obviously only works if somebody wants to change. But it sounds to me like your friend may not be a psychopath because psychopaths don't, they love the lack of empathy and the lack of conscience. It's a positive thing for them.
They find it liberating?
Yeah, they do. It frees them up to do terrible things and there's no problem for them. Now, the fact that your friend is a paedophile and presented himself for therapy makes me think, well, he's a paedophile, but perhaps he's not a psychopath. And the real problems come when you're both. Because if you have a sexual perversion, a dangerous sexual perversion, and at the same time you're a psychopath, so there's no moral boundaries, that's when you've got a real problem. Most psychopaths aren't paedophiles, and I'm sure a great many paedophiles aren't psychopaths. But when you've got the two in that Venn diagram, that's when you have, you know, real danger.
I think few people would disagree that psychopaths with violent and very harmful tendencies to hurt other people need to be confined in such a way that they can't hurt other people. On the other hand, you describe in the book some efforts to cure them that really just sound like cruel and unusual punishment.
Yeah, it was in the 1960s when they were trying LSD on on everything. It was, I wrote the book, The Metastatic Goats, about how the US military was trying things like LSD and so on to create a super soldier. And There was a mental hospital in Canada called Pentanguishene that tried the same thing. The psychiatrist there was a bit of a hippie and had spent a lot of time in these naked hot tub encounter sessions in Northern California, and tried to get his psychopaths to in a ward in the mental hospital to take all their clothes off and take huge amounts of LSD and basically go to their furthest emotional places to try and bring the madness to the surface so it could be treated. And they went through these long, harrowing programs that eventually were declared cured and released into the world. And it turned out that under normal circumstances, 60% of psychopaths who leave prison and go into the outside world go on to reoffend. But the ones who'd been through the naked LSD sessions, 80% of them went on to reoffend. So it just made them worse.
Wow. 1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. So after you hung out and took the session with Robert Hare, did you find yourself sort of labeling people around you as having psychopathic traits?
Yeah, very, very much so. You know, people who crossed me over the years, I wondered which one of them I could out as psychopaths. And also people I didn't put in the book, people I'd had problems with on Twitter, for instance. And I had no idea. In fact, I remember going to Toronto in the middle of this where they were premiering the Many State Goats film, and I was telling the screenwriter all of this stuff. I was saying, oh, you know, this is the answer to everything, and now I can see them everywhere. And they give themselves away with these nuances. And he was saying to me, yeah, it looks like you've gone completely power-crazed here, John. You know, you've changed. And I said, oh, no, I haven't changed. You know, you're the naive one. But I really did change. The psychopath checklist turned to be quite psychopathic, turned to be quite power mad. And I luckily learned from it, and my book reflects the journey that I went on. But I think a lot of people don't learn from it, and I think there's a lot of people in positions of power, psychologists who court experts and so on, who determine the rest of people's lives, who are power-crazed and are very quick to label anybody with unusual behavior.
John Ronson is my guest. His new book is called The Psychopath Test, A Journey Through the Madness Industry. We'll be back in a moment. You can get to us by sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is author John Ronson. His new book is called The Psychopath Test, A Journey Through the Madness Industry. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org. So, John, full disclosure here, thanks to the mixed blessings of Google, you can go online and find, I guess, a version of this, a really simplified version. And I took it. And it, first of all, it makes you sort of nervous as you answer the questions, not because I wanted necessarily to score a certain way, but I wanted to make sure that I understood what they were asking me. And anyway, I got a 4. So I
good. Okay. Well, a 4 is good.
Okay.
I think I'd give myself about a 2. Mm-hmm. But 4 doesn't make you significantly
more. So I'm twice as psychopathic as John Ronson.
No, but really, there is a very, very big difference, because high scores you're talking about in the 20s, uh-huh, and really high scores you're talking about in the 30s. It goes up. There's 20 traits, and you can score 0, 1, or 2, and so it goes up to 40. And the clinical cutoff in the United States is 29 or 30 out of 40. Interestingly, I discovered last night, the clinical cutoff in the United Kingdom is only 25, which means that people in America tend to not mind.
We have a higher tolerance.
Yeah, you've got a higher tolerance than we have, which I thought was very interesting. So I think, you know, if you score in anything up to 15, you're kind of fine.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go to Diane in Grapevine. Hi, Diane.
Hello there.
Hey.
that was interesting topic that you brought up there in terms of feeling uncomfortable with how you were answering the questions, because you want to be sure that you understand what they're getting at, what they're trying to ask you.
Mm-hmm.
I've noticed in my online job search that there are interview questions, and then, I mean, there's a whole bunch of interview questions they'll do for some of these really kind of basic type of jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the questions that they ask that just stands out right now for me is, do you enjoy getting people to do things, to do what you want them to do?
Hmm. What do you know about that, John?
Well, that's so interesting because, of course, that speaks completely to one of the items on the psychopath checklist. And what I do know is that Robert Hare has a team of people that go out to job interviews, and they're asked to quietly assess the candidates for psychopathy. And one of them told me, I didn't put this in the book stupidly, one of them told me that he was always a little bit worried that if he pinpointed a candidate as a psychopath, instead of rooting them out, they'd give them the job, because psychopathy can be a very seductive business tool. But of course, some items on the checklist, if you just have a couple, can be positives. You know, I mean, my anxiety stops me from doing certain things. Being manipulative, I can see why that can be a positive in certain circumstances. Certainly, NLP, you know, the business, the technique of teaching people how to be better salespeople thrives on teaching people how to be more manipulative.
Yeah, not necessarily with evil intentions, just trying to make the sale.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm not anti-capitalist. One of the shocking things about my book is it shows how capitalism at its most unbridled and ruthless echoes psychopathy in quite an eerie way. But I'm not against the system.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we'll speak with James in Plano. Hi, James.
Hey, Chris and John. How are y'all?
Great, thanks.
Good. Okay, so I've actually been labeled a sociopath by a number of psychologists and psychiatrists. When I was younger, my mother used to take me. I've had a long history of juvenile delinquency and of behavioral problems. I'm 29 now. There's a lot of stuff that, a lot of emotional problems when I was younger. And every time we would go to a psychiatrist or a psychologist that would actually come out and say that I was honest with, and they would come out and say, hey, this kid has got problems. He's a sociopath. Mm. I would manipulate my way up out of that psychiatrist's office. And so I imagine that of course the ability to go undetected is part and parcel with the actual problem. But lately, I guess I've been able to sublimate some of my manipulative energies into sales, and this is going to be a bad advertisement for church, but into missionary work. And I'm really good at it. I mean, my church loves me. They're always trying to send me out with the missionaries. And so I just want to say that I hope that there's hope for me and those, those 1 in 25 out there. And I'm sure that they're listening if those numbers are accurate. So I just want to also thank you, John, for your work and give you a
thank you. And obviously what you're saying is incredibly interesting. And I suppose what it speaks to is if you have a neurological lack of empathy, you don't necessarily have to be a malevolent person.
Yeah. Well, I really appreciate his candor there, too.
Right. Yeah, no, I very much appreciate it. Is he still on the line? Because I'd love to ask him more questions.
We don't have him on the line. I think he hung up. But
Right. Well, I mean, how interesting was that?
Yeah, and it's great to think about, this idea that you can, with some hard work, sort of channel the things that could be really problematic. The other question that James's story raises for me, John, is whether or not a tendency towards psychopathy changes over time, because they ask a lot about early life and getting into trouble with the police. And for a lot of people, there might be a run-in with the cops when you're in high school, but then they go on to lead normal lives. Does this diminish as people age?
Well, the nihilistic answer to that, my guy Tony in Broadmoor, who we spoke about at the beginning of the hour, he's just been released and he's in his early 30s. And when I said to a couple of psychologists that he's just been released, their response was always, oh dear, because the idea that a guy in his early 30s who's still got a lot of energy and ambition will go on to behave in a malevolent manner. And the kind of rather nihilistic conclusion that a lot of psychologists come to is that they only stop being malevolent when they get a bit too old and lazy to do it. So when they get into their 40s or 50s or 60s and they're just too lazy to get up off of the sofa. But the other thing at the beginning of life, something I'm incredibly interested in but I have no answer to, is the possibility that maybe, because it's all to do with amygdala function,
yeah,
whether when you get into your adolescence, because a lot of adolescent kids start to behave temporarily in a somewhat psychopathic manner, that just it's just part of the wonderful tapestry of growing up, whether in adolescence amygdala function begins to change and the amygdala starts to underperform as, you know, just at, during that age, and which doesn't make them psychopaths, but it, obviously it just means that one goes through a slightly psychopathic stage. I'd love to know whether any neurologist has done any study on that.
Yeah, that is a fascinating question.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
We have an email here from Kelly in Fort Worth, who is a big fan, and asks, after doing the research for the psychopath test, would you have approached the interviews for Them and Secret Rulers any differently?
Well, some of the, I mean, I'm quite glad, actually, that in my previous work, I didn't know anything about psychopaths, because my books tend to work really well when I connect with my interviewees on an empathetic level. And I never, ever want to demonize people, even if they're members of the Ku Klux Klan or they're Islamic militants. I always want to try and find the humanity in them. And so if I was on the lookout for psychopaths among my earlier interviewees, maybe some of the humane empathy of those earlier books wouldn't have been there. So I'm quite glad that I didn't do that.
Is there a pathology associated with too much empathy?
Oh, gosh. Well, I mean, this is a guess, but I wonder whether anxiety disorders and depression at times could come from too much empathy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, my anxiety problems aren't anywhere near as bad as other people's, but I've always seen anxiety and empathy as being pretty much, you know, two sides of the same coin.
And probably helpful in your line of work.
Yeah, absolutely. I think a surfeit of empathy is kind of my superpower, that I can interview somebody and sort of know what's going on, understand their fragilities.
Yeah.
Because I share them.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we'll speak with Tony in Dallas. Hey, Tony.
Hey. It seems like I have always heard that people in general are very poor judges of themselves. In other words, their self-knowledge is very limited, and I just wonder about the validity of any testing that involves self-reporting. And I'll take my answer on the radio. Thanks.
Thank you. Well, psychologists who work with psychopaths would absolutely agree with that. They would say that manipulative, unempathetic people are the worst people to be involved in their own diagnosis. But I don't think it's true with other disorders. It's certainly not true in my experience with people suffering anxiety disorders. They become part of the process of diagnosis.
Well, I suppose with anxiety, you're hyper aware that everything is, it feels very threatening to you.
Yeah, absolutely. And you're very, very conscious. Obviously, if you suffer OCD, you're very, very conscious of the irrationality. You're separate from the irrationality and can look at it in a rational way. So that actually makes OCD sufferers easier to treat, easier to cure, because they're aware of it being this odd thing about themselves.
We have an email here from Madeline, who says, I really like the sense of being in the moment as I read the book. Did you tape record your interviews with your subjects, or did you take notes?
I tape recorded them, all using the voice memo app on my iPhone, which is fantastic. I would recommend any journalist do that. You just switch it on, and it's great. I will only take notes these days if there was some really good reason that I can't use the iPhone. So, for instance, when I visited Toto Constant in jail, I had to take notes. Luckily, I brought some hotel notepaper along with me because the prison officers were being very grumpy about it. The voice memo app, I just use that routinely now.
Was it hard to get in to see these people? I mean, what kind of hoops did you have to jump through to say, go visit Tony or Toto?
It was actually really easy. The Scientologists, because they're so focused on trying to destroy psychiatry, understand completely how to circumvent bureaucracy. So, for instance, to get into Broadmoor, they said, don't say journalist, say scholar. So that's what I did. Hmm. With Toto, I was amazed at how I phoned them up, the prison, and I said, can I come and visit? And they said, yeah, just whatever. And I said, what, do you want to know the name of the prisoner? And they said, nah. I said, are there visiting times? And they said, nah. So I drove like 6 hours from New York thinking, this is bound to not work. And I turned up at the jail just randomly at about midday, and sure enough, they let me in, and I met the guy.
So as I go through and read people's books to interview them on the show, I make notes as I go along, and sometimes I'll see that I've written the same thing more than once on the pads of paper that I'm using. With this book, I wrote, what does it mean to be sane? That was like the prevailing question that I was left with.
Yeah, absolutely. And I certainly have come to believe that our insanities are more powerful in our lives than our sanities. And maybe that's a good thing. Maybe the happy ending to this story is, let's be a little bit less conformist, a little bit more tolerant of people's eccentricities and their insanities, because that's quite often the thing that leads them to do kind of interesting things. This is the problem with reality TV. It's all based on conformity. It's all based on mocking the troubled person. Hmm. And I rather wish reality TV would become a little bit more gently celebrating of people's idiosyncrasies instead of laughing at them.
You actually found that there are reality TV producers who deliberately go looking for people who appear to be somewhat mentally ill.
Yeah, absolutely. One producer I met said that she did a little secret trick where she'd ask them what medication they're on, and if they were on something like lithium, which would infer a really problematic mental illness, she wouldn't have them on. But if they were on something like Prozac, which would infer that maybe they're angry and they're wound up and they might snap in an entertaining way, that's the right, she said, that's the right sort of mad.
Hmm. Are you already, have you chosen the subject for your next book?
I think so. I'm not entirely sure. I mean, right, the very next thing I'm doing is I'm working on a movie. I've written a movie about being in a band, which hopefully is going to be filming this year. I wrote it with the guy who wrote the Many Stay at Goats screenplay.
We'll keep an eye out for it. I'm afraid we're out of time now. The new book by John Ronson is called The Psychopath Test, A Journey Through the Madness Industry. John, it's been really fascinating. Thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Chris, I really enjoyed it. Thank you very much.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
The Think production team includes engineer Nilufer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.